Now, one of the weak points in socialism, it has not applied yet. Now, because of the technicality of the situation, the real socialism will come when, as we say, when the majority of the people become socialists. And because of the technicality of the situation, you see, we have general elections. You see, one of those countries like this country, or United States of America, or Canada, or France, you know, one day one of those countries will go to the house of the power, the representatives of the socialists, the real socialists, which we represent. So one of the, because of the technicality, one of those countries before everyone will go to the socialist, become a socialist. So that time, you know, for example, if it happens in this country, if one day this country will become the first country become a socialist, and when the Socialist Party of Great Britain sends enough MP so that they have the majority at least by one. So after that, you know, it depends, you know, how the Socialist Party of Great Britain and, you know, with cooperation with the majority of the socialists of this country, how can they accommodate themselves to apply socialism in a world of still capitalism. So if they could accommodate themselves and to show to the people, you know, how socialism works, that it triggers, you know, suddenly, you know, by next general election, France goes to socialism. Then next Spain, then next America. So gradually, you know, you will have more socialism. So of course, that's my own personal view.
One small point about that. Of course, I do realise that a friend here was trying to dig a bit deeper and try to work out what we're going to do with perhaps people who may be violent in this form of society, perhaps how we would defend ourselves. Of course, we're not envisaging any minority capable of approaching a mass majority conscious of its interests. That's the only way you're going to get socialism. Let's get a mass majority capable of understanding that they want socialism. You're not going to get it. So let us just try to create a hypothetical situation. If under that, the capitalists want to come out and fight, well, Prince Charles, perhaps, he's not going to be leader of the cavalry, because, you know, he keeps falling off his horse. you may say to the capitalists, okay, we'll have the fight. Where do you want to have it? Do you want to have it in Ireland or Jersey? Do you want to have it in some other smaller islands? Yes, because not very many of them. And all just get a deep, throw a phlegm, throw one spittle at them and sink them.
I think
this chap is worried about, you know, people who are not nice to each other, don't get on, and it will never make sausage, because we're asking for people to get on and get together. Now, when I hear people say that workers or people are selfish, it makes my bloody blood boil. I'll tell you what. Now, workers get up every morning, they go to the work, they knock themselves stupid with work all their lives, giving away the wealth that they produce for an idle lot of bastards. To me, that's not selfishness. This is generosity verging on bloody madness. Now, this is what you all do. We all do it. I did it myself till I retired. Worse now, I only got the social security. But you see them in the buses, in the tube, knocking themselves spark out for some idle bastard sitting in the south of France or whatever. This isn't selfishness. Now, when you argue with Christians, the worst religion that ever was spawned, in my honest opinion, when you argue with Christians, you say, oh, it's impossible. You must be nice to each other. You must... Now, within the constraints and the day-to-day brutalities of this system we live under, if I did what the Christians did, I'd be laying in the gutter and everybody would be walking all over me. You can't do these bloody things. The system won't let you. So why are people selfish? Because they've got to survive within a vile, rotten system that's outlived its usefulness and it's got to be got rid of. More power to our elbows. Workers of the world, unite.
From this fellow, he mentioned about India. Didn't India have 20 million surplus ton of grain and had 20,000 troops protecting it to see that nobody got to it?
Yes, Commander, you know, as I said in my speech, you know, I said India exports food, yeah. You know, but the problem in our, you see, we have capitalism in India, and India has a map, plenty of people. But however, you know, there is the problem now, the ruling capital, the ruling class of India is greedy. You know? It doesn't want to see that all the Indian people, the standard of living of all the Indian people
is capitalism.
Sorry?
There's a capitalism in India.
Of course, yeah. The ruling class, of course, capitalism, yeah.
They can't turn along and they don't know how to distribute the grain.
They've got rubies to do that.
Yeah, but it's not the question, because you see, it's the profit system, you know. They produce for profit. And for the start, you know, you see, especially Indian people, they have two problems. First problem, that's capitalist problem, they produce for profit. And there is no enough means of the production to produce, so that, you know, to produce enough to cover the needs of everyone. Of course, you know, even if they produce to cover the needs of everyone, they have to create employment so that everyone has the power to buy. So that's, you know, the first problem. The second problem, the ruling class of India, you know, you see, they don't want to see the majority of the Indian people, you know, the lower class, let us call them the highest class and the lower class. They hate the lower class, you know. They simply, even, you know, they don't want to see them, you know, to move towards, you know, prosperity and better standard of living. You know, it's a social hatred. So you see, if you are in India, a member of the ruling class, even if you have 1 million power, you will not invest it. You will not invest it, you know, you will invest it if you get employment from the ruling class. But you know, if you couldn't get employment from the ruling class, because you so much hate the majority of the people or the lower class, you simply will not invest. You say, no, let them remain like that. So you see now that's the problem of the Indian people.
All right.
You have mentioned that the question
before here raised the point about the role of the party in socialist society. I think it's a very important question. The function of the Socialist Party, the World Socialist Movement parties abroad, is to get socialism, not to administer it. We don't want a sort of bureaucratic capitalism like exists in Russia, China, Angola, Mozambique, etc. So, probably clear up that point, didn't we?
Yeah, I was going to mention it about that, yeah.
Sure. I mean,
let's add a lot more than that. See, I think a very valid point is made by probably Putin. See, the object of the Socialist Party of Great Britain is the establishment of this system of society. After this system of society is established, the Socialist Party of Great Britain and its companion parties, incidentally, across the world, which is very importantly pointed out, when the society is established, there will be no room for classes and no room for political parties. The working class will no longer exist. Which is human beings interacting for the best possible world, the best possible mode of production, and the best possible mode of distribution.
Yeah. Can I also say the same point? Say, when you get a sizable majority of socialists in socialist parties in different countries in the world, leading up to the eventual establishment of socialism, before you expropriate the capitalist class through the democratic means of parliament or other institutions in other countries, socialists will be organising the productive capabilities of what they see around it in order to transform it into production for use. They will be organising for a socialist society before they get the socialist society. You know what I mean? But when they do get it, the majority of socialists in each country, which will be more or less simultaneous, ideas are more or less worldwide at the present moment in time. Socialist ideas will be held by a majority of people more or less at the same time. Maybe there won't be a majority of countries fully committed to the ideas. Maybe a few small cookies here and there, not quite a bit. Maybe they can integrate afterwards. But we're talking about the vast majority of people in the world, in the vast majority of countries, consciously setting up production for use. And when a sizable majority of them are there, they will be organised more or less. They will understand what the capabilities and potentialities of production for a social society is, and whether disappropriate, the capitalists through Parliament will be ready to establish more or less the system of production for use in a short time afterwards, you know? So, it's a lot of action going on. We're practical people.
You've laid out a very interesting programme of how the country going, or the world is going to move from capitalism to socialism by a raised consciousness of the people involved. Can you give me some idea of the scale of this operation? I mean, how many people in this country would you at this moment say are, by your own definition, socialists? How many more are becoming members each year?
600.
Maybe
more.
He's actually asking directing the question to the speakers, not the audience. Could I remind the audience?
I thought it was maybe a general opinion.
You put the question in a way that suggests motion, dynamic is the word I'm looking for. You say the scale of the operation rather than to look at it in a freezed way. And it's something that I would agree with, because the number at the moment is very small, but you're talking about a process of people transforming their ideas. I think that's the significant point. So the number is very small, 600 or something, who are actually members of the Socialist Party. But that doesn't give you an accurate picture of the seriousness of the descent in opinion from capitalism, which must be very much wider and very much more forceful than a simple head count of members of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And there are a number of ways of looking at it. First of all, there are thousands of people, millions, in one sort of pressure group or protest group or another, people who've got very serious objections to capitalism that they're actually trying to solve within capitalism, and gradually realising it's a futile effort. There are millions more people who aren't actually paid up members of any organisation, but are just, you know, fed up to the back teeth with every aspect of what living in capitalism means like. Now, it's true that a lot of the time the expression of that discontent is not a socialist expression, but then to answer you in the form of your question, what is the scale of the operation? It's an enormous scale, and capitalism, as it's been said, is producing its own grave diggers. The material conditions of capitalism and the contradiction are constantly stoking up more than just simple disagreement with capitalism, but the actual consciousness that it takes to establish socialism. Because it's pretty, the capitalist class wouldn't have it like that. They wanted to produce literate and numerate wage slaves because it was a more profitable thing to do. But of course, a byproduct of that numeracy and literacy was that people could become better familiar with history and with their own, with the world that they're living in. Of course, all of these things contribute to mean that the level of consciousness, of working class consciousness, and the move towards socialism is a very rapidly growing, particularly as the more capitalism continues, is a rapidly growing movement. I don't know if you can...
To raise the majority of socialist consciousness, we have to make a little investigation in the history of the Industrial Revolution. Now, since the time of the invention of the first machine, up to today, capitalism produced a lot of things. It industrialized means of communication, means of transportation. It developed facilities of education, facilities of medical care. And finally, it produced full employment at some places. Now, because of this, capitalism went into the mind and the heart of the majority of the people. And they thought, it will remain like that. But capitalism, it has a a particular duty that is not to fulfill particular demand, which is industrialization of anything, means of life. Now, during this process of fulfilling this particular demand, because of creating all those such opportunities like full employment and many other things, it went to the mind of the people. But from now over, people will see one of the reasons, because there is plenty of unemployment. They know there is very big, very potential means of the production, but there is poverty, there is problem of housing, there is problem of bad education, there is a lot of unemployment, and there is no future. Now, because of this, now the belief of the people will be reversed. Now when their belief is reversed against the capitalism, when they believe capitalism doesn't work, that time they will have another idea, another solution. Moreover, now the majority of the people, they remember their fathers or forefathers when they were barefooted. But today now they have cancer plan, they look for social security, they feel now this is something from the world. They are very, very thankful for it, and they are very grateful. But future generation will have a different view as the consciousness increases and the education increases. People will understand those things are just nothing. Because the good news of this planet is plenty, it's endless. And everyone is entitled to have as much as he or she needs it. And when the people when they become aware of this, they must make another decision to change the system in their own interest. And that's the only change is to establish socialism.
I think that, some people actually come to me and say, look, socialism is okay for the 1880s and things like this, but isn't it a little bit out of date? Isn't the whole idea about proletariat and Marx and all this a little bit sort of, fade away into the corners? The whole point is not sort of becoming less relevant, it's becoming more relevant. The contradictions that exist in this society have increased over the period of time since the early socialists. Not decreased. And the contradictions will continue as long as people actually insist on continuing this society. Let me give you one example. War. War has become now a total concept. If we have a war, it's going to be the last war. There are no means about going back and actually turning back history when we get the next war, because that's going to be the total one. This is the actual extent to which capitalism increases its contradictions. And other people come to me and they say, look, and you socialists all killjoys. Look, let me tell you, people who have got a house, a car, and a video. I know that people have got these things. They don't want socialism. They've got all what they want. And then when you tell them that in any sane society they should have those things anyway, and they and me are part of the class that actually produce those things, and they should be there for everybody to actually consume. They shouldn't get down on one knee and be grateful for them. They don't seem to have any answer. The contradictions are there, and it's a little bit drifting away from your original question. But so yes, we are a small organisation, but every member counts.
There's one more just.
I just wanted to comment on this. Of course, we're not going to make any bones about it. One of the size of the operation, look at it. See, it's here in front of you. Margaret Thatcher, she speaks on a television set, expressing the interests of the British capitalist class. She's talking to millions. We're talking here about 40 or 50. So, we're not hiding anything from anyone. unfortunately, the situation is it's the capitalist who's hiding information from you, as Sarah Tisdall just found out, and others of you may find out in the future as you try to find the difficulties just having access to the British Library. Now, what is possible should be the question in your mind. But advancement in information technology, we're all well aware, but the first and foremost interest of the development of information technology, if anyone's been reading the history of Reuters recently, who are selling some of their stocks and shares, you'll find that they have been forerunners in information technology for the last 100 or so years. And every piece of development in information technology that was of any use went to Reuters first, and they used it for the exploitation of this technology to get the capitalists access to information as soon as possible. Now we find a position where with not a great deal of money can we get access to some of the machinery that is useful in the expansion and the expression of ideas that we are now capable of using as technology. My friend says earlier that consciousness is the key to socialism. What a key to consciousness is information and communication. Now, information and communication and ideas is what we're all about. And with your help, we can express our ideas sooner. Without your help...
I just want to add, in relation to this last point about it wasn't just how big is the scale of operations of our member, it's also how fast is it growing. As a member of the local branch of the Socialist Party, I think it's only fair for me to add that the local branch, which organised this meeting, has more than doubled its size over the last 18 months. In fact, over the last 4 years, the local branch has multiplied its size 5 times over. So you can see there's quite a dynamic growth rate in the moment.
Yes, to elaborate on Gary's point of view, or you know, the speakers in general, where I went last Saturday, I attended a conference organised by Scott Bardo, whose theme of the conference was the Commonwealth or Common Ownership. Now, 500 people attended this meeting, and it represented a huge number of different organisations, and these 500 individuals went along there specifically to listen to a lecture on common ownership. Now, the thing is that what permitted the questions which followed, you know, gives credence to our ideas that there is a slow conscious awareness of people's desires and understanding about what they really feel about common ownership. Although they were misguided in their views, nevertheless, that one gets this feeling that this is what, you know, society wants. Anyway, just as a further point, I've arranged a debate with this organisation and they have willingly accepted it, which will cover, but it's to extend the whole of these 500 people and all of these organisations which they represent. And they are willingly, you know, quite willing to, you know, debate or have a forum with us, just for the purpose of information.
Before we have any other questions as opposed to comments, are there any comments?
Shall we go to that?
Listening to the contributions that have been made and the questions that have been asked, I think we've got to be quite clear on how we understand the process of change. You know, politicians, Labour and Tory, in my experience, they talk about, they say, well, your society won't be perfect, nothing is perfect. I don't know how they arrive at that situation, that conclusion, because there's no such thing as perfectibility. And they say, another thing they say, well, okay, it's all a very good idea, but it won't take place overnight. Well, of course, people who say that don't really understand the process of change. All qualitative changes take place overnight or relatively rapidly. The quantitative change that we're talking about is a change in human consciousness. That's going on now. Now, we take the view that socialism can be understood by human beings generally. There's nothing in the human makeup to prevent that. All that prevents consciousness is the fact that for reasons, one reason or the other, individuals are not accepting what is, to us, the obvious solution to problems. Now, it's obvious to me that if you're postulating a situation where we say that it's consciousness that is the key, and the growth of that consciousness is something that takes place all the time at varying speeds. Nobody can say how quick it's going to be. But the point is that during the process of accumulation of quantity, as it were, more and more socialists, surely that will bring about a state of affairs which will modify capitalism to the extent that when the qualitative change takes place, quite a number of the problems would have been alleviated. And I would suggest that the problem of war, for example, and the problem of starvation will be well on the way of being solved. The capitalist class, because of the growth of socialist knowledge, the power of the working class with consciousness will force the capitalist class to dish out reforms on a bigger and much qualitative scale. And consequently, that quantitative change will be something which is taking place. The stumbling block, of course, is to get people to understand. If you want a change in society, then it's got to be taken by human beings. No other factor, no other force is going to help us change society. If you want a change in society, it has to be done by human beings. And I think that that's what you should really get to grips with. Those people who think, who question us, how is it going to take place? It'll only take place when the majority of people understand and desire the change. Nothing else is going to happen.
Colin Chair, I would like to say that we shouldn't forget the fact that outside of this room and outside of the Socialist Party, there are hundreds of thousands, millions of working class people who are struggling to try to change society in various ways. And I would put it to you in this way, that if passion was going to change history, then the working class would have had socialism a long time ago. I mean, outside of this room now, take a look at some of the things going on. You've got a miners' strike. Now, however that strike started and however it's conducted, we can't deny one thing, that you've got thousands of working class men and women out there who are committed in solidarity with each other. They want to try and keep their communities going. The passion that's generating that dispute is worth more in energy than all the coal that's under the ground. So you've got that going on. And at the same time, just down the road here, you've got a group of silly, undemocratic romanticists having a little adventure at the North London Polytechnic, where they barricaded themselves in the Polytechnic for a day, probably about the longest most of them have ever been in there, incidentally. And they've done it in order to keep out some little wimp in the National Front who wants to go and get an education. Now, I would have thought that anyone in the National Front who wants to get an education should be given a bloody moving stairway to get in the door. But they're trying to keep the bloke out. So what we would say about that is, you go down to the North London Polytechnic, and I hope Al Branch is going to be going down there giving out some leaflets, and you can see the passion that's involved, the commitment, the sense of doing something that workers have got. We've got an organisation in Britain called the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And every time they have a demonstration, you get thousands and thousands of people out onto the streets. And they're talking about, we've got to defend civilization against a bomb. Incidentally, you can walk all the way from Hyde Park to Trafalgar Square and you won't bump into any civilization. But they're all there to defend it against being destroyed. Now again, you've got tremendous passion in the kind of commitment and enthusiasm that us workers have got was channeled into socialism. You think where we've been a couple of years ago. You know, when I was at school, they taught me that you don't have riots in Britain. The British people are peaceful. Well, they obviously didn't live down my street for a start, people like those history books. But the British people are peaceful. And then all of a sudden, you get riots in Brixton, riots in Toxteth, you even get riots in Bristol. Now, when you get riots in Bristol, you know that things are starting to move. And that was happening as well. Now, what are the working class, what would the ruling class say? The ruling class look at the miners' strike, and you've got Ian McGregor rubbing his hands, because the miners are doing the National Coal Board's job for them. They're keeping the pits shut. They're keeping the coal supply stopped during the summer months when the National Coal Board doesn't want it. And that's why you don't see Ian McGregor coming on television appealing to the miners to go back to work, any more than the National Union of Teachers, or my union, the AUT. You don't see, we're in a pay dispute at the moment. You won't see the ruling class rushing onto television, or onto Channel 4, which we all watch, and saying, we demand that the philosophers and the historians and the economists come back to work. I mean, people in my profession could stay out of work for 5 years, no one would have noticed. So, particularly the students at the North London Polytechnic. So, you've got that. So, the ruling class are looking at that. They're not worried about the miners. The ruling class are looking at the North London Polytechnic. They're not worried about that. They think, well, look, if the students want to barricade themselves in, you know, maybe even one or two of them will accidentally lock themselves in the library. They might even come and revise for their exams. We're not worried about that. They take a look at the riots. When the riots were going on, the ruling class weren't worried about that. They sent Michael Heseltine up to Liverpool with his aide following close behind. And they said, we're not worried about that. We're not worried about that. We'll build you a few leisure centres. And there's no problem there. In fact, as a matter of fact, when the riots were going on in Britain, the ruling class complained because when the looting was going on, the only thing left in the bloody shop windows were the royal wedding souvenirs. They couldn't even get people to loot them. Now, the thing about it, and this is the point that I want to make, is that the working class has got tremendous enthusiasm across the world, wherever you go, and what warms my heart wherever I go is you see workers on the fiddle. Every job you go into, there are workers cracking corners, ripping things off, coming out of work at night, looking like pregnant women with fireflies under their pullovers. I mean, I've had so many, my stomach stayed like this. So you end up in a position where the working class are committed in all sorts of ways to changing things, to dissent. The average worker you talk to says to you, for Christ's sake, I'm fed up with it. I want something different. Now, why, therefore, we say, join the World Socialist Movement? Because when you join the World Socialist Movement, you're turning around to the robber class, because that's what they are, whether they're in Russia or China or Britain, the robbers of the world, and you're saying to them, we're not going to loot from the shops in Brixton or Toxteth. We're not going to go and squat in your second-rate houses. We're not going to bleed for you to give us a job down a coal mine. We're not going to demand, if we're women workers, to be just as inferior as men workers and then call that equality. We're not going to demand, if we're living in Africa or Latin America, to be free from colonial oppression so that we can have the liberation of native oppression. We're going to simply play the robbers at our own game and rob the world away from them. And if the capitalist class was listening to this meeting and they heard that at the end of tonight, one, two, or three people had decided to join the Socialist Party, they would be as sick as I would be delighted.